Hi, everybody. Let me just begin by saying something that is likely to be old hat for many people in this room, but that I think is useful in light of some conversations I had with people in the days after last week's lecture. One of the things I'm trying to do in this series is to ask some of the biggest and most basic questions about what it means to be a human being in the way that I think it's fair to say a majority of Jewish sources and thinkers have tended to ask those questions. That is, rather than talking about abstract philosophical categories, I'm trying to read classical received narratives, otherwise less pretentiously called Torah, trying to read Torah and try to figure out what we might learn about what it means to be a human being by exegeting, commenting on texts. In some ways, some of the most interesting Jewish philosophical comments made in the history of the Jewish tradition are made not in a kind of book that says it's a book of philosophy, but in a book that is trying to interpret Cain and Hevel or many other such sources. So in some ways what I'm trying to do is actually very continuous with the way Jews read, and it's kind of an interesting process that I've run in my own life where I find myself spending less time doing what I used to do, which is reading kind of analytic philosophers of religion, and more time trying to figure out what Parshat Noach means, because in some ways I find that more humanly compelling at this point. Be happy to have that conversation privately with anyone who's interested. It also should not surprise anyone that given that we're asking basic questions about what it means to be human, we are spending the bulk of our time, both last week and tonight, on Breishit Prakim Aleph Tiyur Aleph, Genesis 1-11. It should not be surprising because those are the chapters that are explicitly, anyway, about being human rather than being Jewish in particular. That's not to say, obviously, as we'll see also tonight, that there's not a lot to be learned about what it means to be human from narratives about the covenant between God and Israel, but that those chapters in particular are preoccupied with the sort of foundational questions of human life. What is a person? What does it mean to be a person created in the image of God? What does it mean to sin? What does it mean to sin in the presence of a God who is forgiving? What does it mean to sin in the presence of a God who also judges? What does it mean? We could go on like this. This is all before we get to Abraham. So it's not so surprising that those are the chapters that we're focused on. In terms of tonight's topic, what can human beings accomplish? I regretted after the email went out that I did entitle it, What Can Human Beings Accomplish? And what can't they? Because in many ways, that's the topic. Those are the twin topics of tonight's talk. And I want to share just a tiny bit of historical context for how I first started to think about this question in the context of Chumash, in the context of the Torah. In the 1960s, there was a movement in Christian theology that for a while had a lot of cultural cachet, made the cover of Time magazine at one point, called the Death of God movement. And one of the many claims that theologians of the death of God, paradoxical as that expression sounds, made is that in order for human beings to come of age, any notion of a traditional God needed to get buried, because there was a kind of zero-sum game between divine power and human capacity. Either God was omnipotent or human beings had the power to do stuff in the world. But it couldn't be both ways. And one of the things that is actually quite striking to me, it was striking to me when I first started reading these figures in college, is what an atrociously bad reading of Chumash that seems to me to be based on. Whatever one might say about later philosophy, later forms of piety, it's a terrible reading of the Bible to think that there's any kind of zero-sum game between divine power and the capacity of human beings to shape and meaningfully impact their world as a whole and their individual lives in particular. I'm going to try to really kind of explore a little bit of that tonight. So I want to begin not with Genesis 1-11, but actually with Exodus 14, which is, I think, one of the most powerful scenes in the Hebrew Bible, and yet it is often, like a lot of the most powerful scenes, because it's familiar, we read over it way too quickly. And one of the sort of unapologetic goals of this series is also to sort of return us to texts that many of us feel we know inside out, and try and uncover just how much is going on in these texts that we tend to miss. So Exodus 14, the scene is totally terrifying. The Israelites have just escaped Egypt. God has entered into history and ended their slavery in Egypt. They are running towards the sea, and Paro changes his mind. Pharaoh changes his mind and decides to chase them, and he means business. And the way the Torah, in its kind of inimitable literary style, makes clear that Paro means business is by repeating over and over again the word rechev, chariot. Right? You see the word chariot happening all over again. Every chariot in Egypt is coming for them. Now, picture the scene. They've got the sea in front of them, the Egyptians behind them, and they're terrified. And what do they do as a result of their terror? They turn on Moses with a vengeance and basically accuse him of taking them out of one place where they suffered but at least lived to another place where they are sure to die. And it's important not to do in a way what some of my teachers in elementary school did, which is to immediately move to vilify the Israelites. Right? It's important, I think, also to have a moment of capturing the pathos of their experience. The oppression in Egypt was horrific, but it was also, if nothing else, deeply familiar. And on some level, the demon that we know is safer than the demon that we don't. A large percentage of psychotherapy would be out of business if that were not part of the human condition, right? Being, on some level, being attached to the ways that we know, even as they hurt us. And leaving familiar circumstances, no matter how degrading, is often hard and sometimes downright excruciating. So now the Israelites find themselves liberated from the familiar, but they're forced to confront the terror of the unknown, to live with a moment of desperate uncertainty, and not just uncertainty, but also the very real possibility of imminent death. And what you feel, I think, if you read these verses slowly and closely, is this incredibly potent mix of dread and indignation. They're scared and they're angry. If you look for a moment at source 1, you see how Moses responds to the Israelites. What Moshe says to them is quite interesting. He says, "Don't be afraid. Stand firm, and you will see the deliverance that God will bring you today. The Egyptians you see today, you will never see again. The Lord will fight for you. Adonai yilachem lachem. And you need only be still. Va'atem tacharishun." Moses' instructions to the Israelites, in other words, are wait and watch. Now, God's response is surprising, to say the least. Moses seems to be defending God to the Israelites, and God's response is to let Moshe have it. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Matitz akelai, what are you crying out to me for? Daber el bnei Israel v'yisa'u. Tell the Jewish people to move." Right? The Talmud loves this moment because it basically uses as a paradigm for there are moments when you have to be an idiot to be praying. There are moments when you should be moving, right? There's an enemy behind you. Now, this is an odd thing for God to say, not least because, as Or HaChaim and other Jewish commentaries say, where are they supposed to move exactly? The Egyptians are behind them, the raging sea is in front of them, and God is saying, walk. Also, it's odd, by the way, that the text says nothing about Moshe praying to God. Moshe just says, stand still and watch what God does. And God says, what are you crying to me for? Moses didn't actually pray. Litzok is a language of prayer, and that actually didn't happen. Now, but more importantly and more fundamentally, what is wrong with what Moshe has said? I think if we understand from the Torah's perspective why Moshe's response, pious as it seems, is misguided, we'll go a long way to understanding the way Jewish theology, or at least biblical theology, understands the nature of faith and human responsibility and the relationship between them. What does it mean to be a slave? A slave is someone who is fundamentally robbed of dignity and freedom. Or, to put this in a way that is more direct and poignant, a slave is someone who has been stripped of a sense of agency. A slave is someone, in other words, who has no capacity to shape her fate or her destiny. Now, think for a minute about the Israelites after generations of enslavement and degradation. In order to go from slavery to freedom in a meaningful sense, in order to truly be transformed, the Israelites will need to discover, however slowly, however painfully, however tenuously, that they have agency, that they can act in ways small and large to determine their own fate. What's wrong with what Moshe says is that unwittingly, he gives them instructions that undermine the very journey they're about to go on. He tells them, in effect, go on being passive. Sit back and watch what someone else does for you. But being totally passive is no way at all to reassert their dignity. If I had to paraphrase God's response to Moshe, to give it flesh, in other words, I would say something like this. God says, in effect, Moshe, don't tell them to be passive. On the contrary, tell them to go forward. Otherwise, we'll never get anywhere in teaching them to be free and helping them to restore their dignity. You can't leave Egypt, not in any real existential way, until you discover that you can take responsibility for your life and affect your fate. Otherwise, you've just taken Egypt with you. Now, here's what's striking about this story, and I want to sort of anticipate a critique and try to flip it on its head. Right? The Exodus is decidedly not a story that is fundamentally about human initiative and human beings shaping their own fate. But even and especially in that context, the Torah goes out of its way to emphasize that even in the context of explicit thunderous divine power and miracle making, the Torah makes space for, and more than makes space for, insists on the centrality of human initiative first. It is only if and when the Israelites first find the courage to move forward that God will save them. In the language of later Kabbalah, it is only if there is first an itaruta dilatata that there can be later an itaruta dilaela. It is only when there is a stirring from below that there will later be a stirring from above. Only human effort sets into place the world of the miraculous. God's miracles are, in some sense, dependent on prior human initiative. Now, I would just add parenthetically, although this in itself can be its own topic for many hours, that there's a simple logic of kal vachomer theologically here, of reasoning from small to large. If, in a world in which God thunders and breaks seas and interrupts history, the Torah goes out of its way to emphasize the centrality and urgency of human effort, all the more so over time as whatever divine intervention there might be in the world becomes more and more subtle. That sentence, by the way, is an encapsulation of the theology of Rabbi Yitz Greenberg that he spent his whole career writing about, right, on some level, is that, which is what happens in a world in which a core idea that's in the Torah plays itself out more and more deeply at a time when God seems to step further and further back. But my point here really is that even Exodus already, so focused on divine agency, makes room for and more insists on human agency. So that's the frame for asking the question, just how much does God value human responsibility? If we turn back a few chapters in Sefer Shemot, we come upon another moment that I think all of us are familiar with, and yet we likely read far too quickly. A moment in which we discover that God accomplishes God's goals not alone for humans, but also through and with us. The moment I'm about to talk about, by the way, becomes central to the theology of Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, which we will talk about a little bit next week. The moment is this. God appears to Moses at the burning bush and announces that God has heard Israel's cries. And then God reveals God's concrete plans. Addressing Moshe, God says, I've heard, and I'm going to do this. I'm going to reveal, to redeem them. And then amazingly, what is the plan for implementing God's commitment to enter history and redeem the Israelites, these amazing, poignant words, Ve'ata lechav eshlachechao paro. And now, you know what my plan is? You go. You go to Pharaoh, and you shall free my people. I just said a minute ago, I shall free my... You go, and you free my people, the Israelites, from Egypt. God intends to free the Israelites and radically alter the course of Jewish and human history. And how will God accomplish God's goals? By finding an anonymous shepherd without a home and saying, you do it. So this lofty world cosmos transforming event now becomes a human project given to one person to implement and push forward into the world. The divine goal becomes a human vocation. And I want to suggest that here the book of Exodus is not just telling us a story about the life of Moshe, but revealing a core aspect of Jewish theology, which is that for the accomplishment of divine aims, God chooses to need people. For the accomplishment of divine aims, God chooses to need people. If that idea sounds familiar, see any page of almost anything ever written by Abraham Joshua Heschel. But interestingly, in terms of how texts are familiar or not familiar, oddly, he never mentions this text as a version of that. Right? It's almost like he read this, like all of us do, fast. Now, if you take these two stories together, the Israelites at the sea and Moses in the presence of God being told, I have a plan, and you know what my plan is? You. You see that here in the book of Exodus, human beings are called to act in the world, both on their own behalf, that's the Israelites at the sea, and on behalf of God's broader vision for the world, that's Moshe liberating the slaves from Egypt. But this is not new in Exodus. As I want to show, I think it's actually fundamental to the beginning of Bereishit, and I want to try to show how that develops, I think, throughout the opening chapters. We saw last week, and it's source 3 on your sheet, the famous verses about Tzelem Elohim, about the image of God. If we saw anything last time, it is that God takes human beings extremely seriously and respects our power and freedom so much that, as we saw, God appoints humanity as God's earthly delegates. God values our capacity to act in meaningful ways and calls us into partnership to help bring about the kind of world God envisions, but does not bring about on God's own. From the beginning, in other words, from the very first chapter of Bereishit, to quote a contemporary Bible scholar named Terry Fretheim, God is a power-sharing, not a power-hoarding God. One of the very first things that God does is delegate and share God's power. That's the meaning of Tzelem Elohim, as we saw, right? I am going to appoint you to act on my behalf. I will not hoard the power that I have. God becomes a kind of cosmic delegator. I have a vision that I want. You do it. As we saw last time, that remains true even after, first of all, the sin in the garden, and second, after the flood. When the Torah goes out of its way to repeat the fact that human beings are created B'Tzelem Elohim in the image of God, even after those moments of profound human failure. And it goes further. The fact that God commands human beings to master the world means that although God deems creation good, God does not deem creation yet perfect. Vayar Elohim ki tov, and God saw that the world was good, I'm suggesting, is not synonymous with, and God saw the world, and behold, it was perfect. God saw it was good, and yet there was room for human agency to make it better. The world created in Genesis 1, not just in Genesis 2, as I emphasized last time, the world created in Genesis 1 already needs human beings to cultivate and develop it. And now for a minute, Zach, Genesis 2. Source 4 makes this extremely clear, right? And it's actually kind of astonishing. I'm reading in English tonight just for the sake of time. No shrub of the field was yet on earth, and no grasses of the field had yet sprouted. Now why? Because God had not sent rain upon the earth, That's reason number one. But also because, and there was no human being to till the soil. So God needs human beings to be there in order to do the work of developing the world. By the way, returning to our theme from last week, so far from this being a theology of everything existing for human beings, Genesis 2 seems to have a theology of human beings existing for the sake of everything. Right? God puts them there so that they will do the work of serving the rest of creation. The human responsibility to till and to tend, le'ovda'u le'shomra, which is mentioned 10 verses later, which you have as part of source 4 here, suggests that people are called not just to maintain and preserve what already exists, but also to bring the world along towards its possible potential. And Avi, your question from last time is right on, and I'm still working on it. What does that mean concretely? But the notion here is, right, that the creation of humanity already is about human beings being pulled in, being summoned, being invited to participate in this divine project. Now, it's even more radical than this, because it's not just creativity in the natural world, that is, cultivating nature, tilling and tending it, but also in the cultural sphere. Or maybe I could say, in the nexus of culture and nature. Source 5 describes human beings being given permission and authority to name the animals. And what happens when they do that? God dramatically and unequivocally validates their choices. Whatever the human being calls these creatures, that indeed is their name. Again, this dramatically generous delegating of power. Genesis 1, which I've included a couple of examples of it, has God naming various aspects of the world God creates. And Genesis 2 is yet another example, subtly, of human beings engaging in imitatio Dei, engaging in God's work. Genesis 1 makes it clear the prerogative to name aspects of creation belongs to God. And what happens in Genesis 2? God says, okay, you name everything else. And whatever name you give them, that's their name. So it's a sharing of a divine prerogative. Remember last time we talked about another form of imitatio Dei, of imitating God, of human beings being like God, in Genesis 1. In Genesis 1, God starts by forming and filling the world, setting it up, pushing away the chaos, and creating life to fill it. And then human beings are given the task of subduing, bringing under control, eliminating chaos, and pru urbu, and spreading out. Forming and filling by God, forming and filling by humanity. And then parallel Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, naming by God, and then naming by humanity. Now I want to give another example. Another one that it is easy to miss, and it also happens to be, if I may be so bold, an interesting biblical argument against arranged marriages. Source number 6. Okay? God decides that it is not good for human beings to be alone. Lo tov heyot ha'adam levado. And what does God essentially do in this story that is so familiar that we miss how bizarre and surprising it is? God says, okay, Adam, do I have a person for you? Right? She's an elephant. She's perfect. Right? And Adam says, I don't think so. And what is God's response? Oh, okay, I'll go back to the drawing boards and figure out someone who would be an appropriate match for you. In other words, Adam is here given authority not just sort of over the broader world, but over the decisions that shape his most intimate life. Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 together, in other words, insist that human decisions about the world and about our lives within it really matter. And not just to us, but also to God. If you think, in a way, that Abraham is the first person to show some chutzpah and saying, I don't know about that. It's actually Adam who says, I'm not interested in her. She's an elephant. Now, the story may strike you as preposterous, but I think the point is actually very important. It's about honoring Adam's ability to decide what's appropriate for Adam. Now, taking this one step further, I want to return for a minute to the world of the ancient Iris, which we talked about last time. Because yet again, if we know something about ancient Near Eastern cultures, we understand biblical narratives in a way we are not likely to understand them if we read them alone. Just how seriously does the Bible take human effort and initiative? Turn again for a moment to Babylonian culture, in which it is very clear that all culture and all civilization are gifts from the gods to human beings. According to a whole range of ancient Near Eastern myths, human beings don't develop any aspect of human culture. It's all done for them. So we're given everything from means of irrigation to, as we saw last time, political arrangements. It's all done for us. One way to see it is, it's about God's absolute power. Another way of seeing it is, the flip side, it's about human beings not being deemed worthy or capable of doing much of any significance. In light of that, I want to ask you for a minute to think about a biblical text that is familiar to many people, and yet we read totally quickly. First, I want to talk for a second about Cain and Abel, and then I want to talk about verses during which most people's eyes glaze over in Shul, which is the genealogy after the Cain and Abel story. So first of all, Genesis 4, remember, the ancient Near East, human beings don't do anything for themselves. Genesis 4, Cain is the first person to build a city, Genesis 4:17. And I'm now at source 7, the bottom of page 3, or the top of page 4. There is a whole progression, a genealogy interspersed in which is Cain is the first to build a city. Yaval invents the herding of livestock. Yuval invents music. Tubal-Cain invents metallurgy. And then, a couple of verses later, Enosh introduces worship of God. Footnote to that, for those who were raised from, right? Chazal, the sages, have to do a lot of work to turn Enosh into a bad guy. Because this is one of the classic cases of two biblical verses running up against each other, the Breishit says that Enosh was the first person, Az huchal likro b'shem yud-hei vav-hei. But what happens in Sefer Shemot? God says to Moshe, I was never known by my name to anybody. So therefore, the sages say, what does huchal mean? Not what huchal means, that is, begun, but huchal milashon chulin. Chulin, then the name of God was desecrated. But if we read Genesis alone, we have yet one more. By the way, they're not just doing small things here. They're inventing religion and the worship of the right God. Later on, a few chapters later, just to keep this going, we learn that Noah plants the first vineyard, and Nimrod is the first hunter and empire builder. Human beings, in other words, in the mind of Sefer Bereishit, are creators of their own culture. Another way to see this is in light of what I talked about last week in the image of God. In the ancient Near East, remember, kings are created in the image of their gods, and therefore, I want to add, it is kings who act in history and shape the course of events, whereas everyone else is expected to be passive. As one contemporary Bible scholar writes, the implications of the idea that only kings are created in the image of God is that other humans are, here I quote, understood to live relatively predetermined lives, beholden to their divine and human overlords, reduced to puppets in a social order in which they had no significant agency or freedom. In the Bible, in contrast, again, as we spoke about, everyone being created in the image of God means that everyone has agency and can act to shape the world and their world. This is what, in fact, chapter 4 of Genesis describes them as doing. The inventors of music, metallurgy, and animal herding are not even great heroic figures or sages or otherwise exceptional characters. They're just people. And not only are they just people, they're descendants of a not particularly impressive lineage. Being a child of Cain is not yichus. It's not that impressive. They're just people. And what are they? What do you know about them? Nothing. They invented music. That's great. They're people. And people are doing the work of building and creating culture. Now, I want to try to read this text closer and show that I think it's more subtle and complicated than a simple celebration or valorization of human effort, which would make this text, as you know, the Bible as a mid-20th century liberal Protestant theological text, right? It's all about human effort. You know, if we just gather all children together, sway and sing Kumbaya, we can redeem the world together. We are the Messiah we've been waiting for, right? That's not what Genesis 4 is arguing for. Valuing human agency and even honoring it does not equal simple-minded embrace of notions of moral or technological progress. And I think that's what makes this seeming genealogy so interesting. On the one hand, Genesis emphasizes that the foundations of human culture and civilization are the projects, the product of human discovery and ingenuity. But on the other hand, attributing these developments to people of such dubious origins as Cain may have a flip side as well. That is, that it may be the Torah's way of reminding us that technological advancement and moral progress are two very different things. What better way to say that progress is not always progress than to say very simply, the guy who invented cities is also the guy who invented murder, which is the power of Cain as a biblical character. The guy who invented cities is also the guy who invented murder. Now, the Torah wants to pull at both ends, and if you think I'm overreading, I'm going to try to convince you in a minute that I'm not. On the one hand, some scholars suggest, I'm not sure they're right, but they suggest, some scholars like Nachum Sarna, who I take seriously, says that the seven generations of the genealogy after Cain, in which a tremendous amount of creativity takes place, is supposed to consciously be a mirror of the 7 days of divine creativity in Genesis 1. Footnote to that, the reason I'm not so sure that's right is it would be a better case if every generation in the genealogy had its own moment of creativity. Whereas in fact what we have is building of city, children, 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 three brothers. In other words, it's not, I don't know if the mirroring really works. But okay, maybe the number of seven is significant. And yet, and here's why I think this is actually pshat in Bereishit if we read slowly. Look where the story of human cultural development ends up. It ends up with a man named Lamech. A man who exalts in his own capacity for barbarism and brutality. That's what he's remembered for. Now his little taunt song, the poem he utters, is notoriously hard to translate. But he says, we'll use the JPS translation, I think is the one I have here. This is verse 24. Sorry, verse 23. Adain, Sila, hear my voice. O wives of Lamech, give ear to my speech. I have slain a man for wounding me and a lad for bruising me. If Cain is avenged sevenfold, then Lamech 77-fold. What has happened is that in the course of 7 generations, technology has progressed, but so also has the propensity for violence and brutality. Morally speaking, in other words, things are getting worse, not better. What do I mean by that? Cain succumbs to sin. Lamech positively glorifies in it. Cain seeks protection. Lamech walks around looking for provocation, even from a small child. So, technological and cultural progress are not panaceas to any problem. Now, in light of that, I want to share with you something that may be familiar to some and not to others, but I think it's an amazing piece of intertextuality, of biblical texts that are playing with each other. One of the most maligned texts in the Hebrew Bible is the halakha, the biblical law of an eye for an eye, the law of talion. Ayin tachat ayin. Petza tachat petza. Chabura tachat chabura. Right? An eye for an eye. A wound for a wound. Now, oftentimes, people who want to criticize the Bible for its ostensible barbarism point to this as maintaining the culture of violence and brutality. And yet, as I think becomes clear when you read Genesis 4, the point of ayin tachat ayin, petza tachat petza is only an eye for an eye, not a life for an eye. Only a wound for a wound, not a life for a wound. How do I know that? Because the words Lemech uses to describe what he hopes to do, ki ish harakti lefitzi, v'yeled lechaburati, I have killed a man for his petza, murdered a child for his chabura, is exactly the language of the law of Talion. Petza tachat petza, chabura tachat chabura, not life tachat petza, life tachat chabura. In other words, Exodus 21 is a conscious repudiation of the ethics of Genesis 4. Now, that doesn't mean, I want to be clear here, this is how people end up in a civilization that can feel frozen. This does not mean that the Torah's purpose here is to freeze for all time the development of criminal justice such that, okay, you hurt my eye, I'm going to take out your eye. The idea is a trajectory. I could give many examples of this in the literature of Chazal, who I think understand themselves that way. But here, I think it's very clear what's going on, which is that the Bible is playing on itself. Right? Exodus is saying, no, part of the goal of the covenant, this is the first set of laws of the covenant, Exodus 21, is to move beyond the ethics of general, uncultivated society as it exists in the time of Lemech. So the point, in any rate, is that seven generations of achievement have passed since Cain's killing of his brother, and yet people are now more bloodthirsty rather than less. Progress in civilization and progress in cruelty are manifestly not mutually exclusive. Right? Read 20th century Germany. People can adore Mozart even as they murder children. Already Lemech is a way of saying precisely that. Music has been invented and introduced in the world. And what happens? Oh, I would kill any little kid who picked on me. Right? Cultural, technological progress does not go hand in hand necessarily with moral progress. Now, the culmination of all this is the flood. And I don't have time to do this at length, but there are some really interesting subtle literary cues that are intended to tell us just how badly people have gone astray. God commands Adam to fill the world. That's Genesis 1:28. Humanity instead fills it, in the words of chapter 6, with violence. Vatimale ha'aretz chamas. God beckons humanity to increase progeny upon the earth. Humanity increases not just progeny, but also wickedness. Genesis 6:5. I don't think I put those sources on here because I wanted to glide over them quickly. And whereas in Genesis 1, Vayar, God sees that everything is good, in Genesis 6, before the flood, God sees the proliferation of Hamas instead. This is the Torah's way of saying that Genesis 6 is how badly astray God's plans in Genesis 1 have gone. That, in a way, is the unavoidable complexity of our condition as human beings. When you get to Genesis 6 and you read the way it's playing with Genesis 1, you realize that on the one hand, we have enormous power to shape the world, a fact that the Torah regards as fundamentally an inherently good thing. And yet we can, and it hardly needs saying, all too frequently do, turn that same potential to appalling, unspeakable ends. After the flood, a new path. God introduces a new path in the world to try and bring human violence under control. What is that path? God introduces law. look at Source 9. Very famous verses. But for your own lifeblood I will require a reckoning. I will require it of every beast. Of man too I will require a reckoning for human life. Of every man for that of his fellow man. Shofech dam ha'adam ba'adam damo yishafech. Ki b'tzelem Elohim asayt ha'adam. Whoever spills the blood of a human being, by a human being shall her blood be shed. For in the image of God, God created humanity. Usually, people pay attention to the first part of this verse. Shofech dam ha'adam, ba'adam damo yishafech. One who sheds blood, their blood shall be shed. They use this as an example of the Torah mandating as law the sanctity and the utter inviolability of human life. And we'll talk about that in a second. But the second part of the verse, often ignored, is at least as important. Being created in the image of God, here I'm quoting the work of Tikva Frymer-Kensky, does not only mean that we can't be killed, it also means that we ourselves must act to prevent, or at least deter, such killing. In other words, when the verse says, Shofech dam ha'adam, ba'adam damo yishafech, when a human being kills a human being, by a human being shall his blood be shed, ki b'tzelem Elohim asayt ha'adam, because the human being is created in the image of God, is not just an explanation of why it's forbidden to kill a human being, but also an explanation of why human beings are responsible for executing justice in that instance. In other words, the seifa, the ending of this verse, ki b'tzelem Elohim asayt ha'adam, is distributed in the verse. I would actually say it's distributed in three ways. One, the victim. Two, why is the murderer forbidden from behaving in this way? And three, why is society responsible for punishing and establishing a system of criminal justice? Because we're created in the image of God. But what's crucial here is that God, again, introduces a plan. What is the plan? Law. How will God execute God's plan? Ba'adam damo yishafech. You will do it. Now, in other words, part of what it means to be created in the image of God is to set up a society where innocent life is protected and justice is enacted. It's important to emphasize that the rabbinic tradition had serious misgivings about capital punishment and effectively did away with it. In practice, if not in theory, see various Talmudic passages in Masechet Sanhedrin about Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Right? The Talmud effectively does away with capital punishment. Nevertheless, the force of the biblical message is clear. And some would argue it's even clearer once the Talmud undoes capital punishment. Here I'm going to quote Tikva Frymer-Kensky again. Human beings must be the ones responsible for making sure that human beings are not killed. God will not act to save the threatened person or to wreak vengeance or bring punishment on the killer. Instead, God establishes a system in which we, the images of God, perform the divine task of preventing and punishing murder. Now, I want to suggest that this is made even more manifestly clear if we slow down and read even slower. Scholars are often puzzled by the relationship between chapter 9, verse 5, and chapter 9, verse 6. Because if you read verse 5, what you discover is, God says, for your own lifeblood, I will require a reckoning. I will require it of every beast. And then verse 6 says, effectively, you require a reckoning. So which one is it? Is it that God requires a reckoning, or that human beings do? That, I want to suggest, is precisely the point. That in juxtaposing these verses, human beings created in the image of God are here asked to do God's work. It's not just about cultivating nature. It's not just about propagating the human species. It's not just about moving the world forward through culture and civilization. It's also in creating a just society in which human blood is not cheap. That is what God decides after the flood. Now you can say this is a kind of crazy God, right? You've totally failed. What am I going to do? I'm going to tell you, you have to create justice. This is a God who is so eager, the God of Genesis, to delegate power, to ask human beings to do the work that the verse before describes as divine work. I will require it of you. How will I do it? Human criminal justice. It is not just, in other words, in the rest of the natural world that humanity is appointed God's delegate, but also, and maybe primarily, in the human world itself. The pursuit of a just society is one of our most elemental tasks, according to Genesis. And that, I hasten to emphasize, is about God's relationship to humanity, not particularly God's relationship to the Jewish people. Right? Not in particular, not exclusively, is what I mean to say. Now, we should be under no illusions, right? Although the Bible does affirm that human beings have free will and that we have the capacity to choose the good, it also points out again and again how often we fail to do that and how disastrous the consequences can all too frequently be. I might have said this at some point to the students who are in the yeshiva this year, but I think it's an interesting thing to think about. It often occurs to me that Judaism and Christianity traditionally have very different notions of tragedy. Right? The Christian notion of the tragedy of the human condition, this is especially true in the Protestant tradition, but it's actually true in the history of Christianity as a whole. The tragedy of human beings is that we are beckoned by God and we are unable to obey God's will. Right? Open up almost any page of Martin Luther, Karl Barth, and you'll discover that the tragedy of humanity is we're given a set of obligations and we're simply incapable of doing it. The biblical and Jewish notion of tragedy, I think, is slightly different, which is the claim that human beings actually are capable of doing it, and yet we don't. In other words, the tragedy of Christianity is the essential inability of human beings to do God's will. The tragedy of Judaism is our refusal despite our ability. That, I think, is the core piece of what's going on in the theology of the book of Genesis. Now, I want to maybe start to bring this to a close by sharing something that, to be honest, I never really noticed or thought about until I started writing about these chapters, which is this very bizarre thing that happens before and after the flood. The reason for the flood, as the Torah describes it, is Ki rabah, I am now in source 10, Ki rabah ra'at ha'adam ba'aretz, v'chol yetzer machshevot libo rak ra kol hayom. The reason why God brings the flood is that human beings, everything they devise is nothing but evil all the time. And then after the flood, God decides to make a commitment never to bring a flood again. And what is the reason that Genesis 8 says that God will never bring a flood again? Lo osif lekalel et odet ha'adama bavur ha'adam. I will never again bring a flood. Why? Because human beings are wicked. Now this is very odd. The reason for God sending one flood has now mysteriously become the reason for God never sending another. It's the very same reason. It's really a very odd thing, right? I'm going to destroy the world because you're wicked. Never going to destroy the world again. Why? Because you're wicked. Now, a variety of translators, who are really functioning as interpreters, as always, attempt to dissolve the paradox by translating ki the second time as although. Right? I will never again destroy the world, although human beings are, the devisings of the human heart, are evil. Except it's odd to choose to translate in one case ki as because and the other case ki as although. That's not driven by the text. That's driven by a desire to dissolve paradox. And if you've ever heard me talk about anything, I think the goal of theology is not to dissolve paradoxes, but to engage them, right? To live with complexity. Better to wrestle than to dissolve what is extremely interesting about this text. Now, here's the thing. This is amazing. The flood didn't work. If the goal of the flood was to change human nature, what's the first thing that God announces after the flood? You know what? You're still pretty problematic. Human nature has not changed, nor, I hasten to add, will it in any eon we can recognize. What has changed after the flood is not human nature, but rather God's attitude towards it. The very same human shortcomings which had called forth doom and destruction in Genesis 6 now elicit God's forbearance and generosity instead. Judgment gives way to mercy and condemnation to compassion. You might even say, somewhat crudely, that in Genesis 6-8, human beings learn nothing, but God seems to learn a lot. Or God seems to change God's mind. There is a crucial lesson here, by the way, about how the very same attribute that we often see as grounds for reproach can actually often be grounds for compassion and forgiveness as well. Think about the way, if you're feeling good about yourself, the way you think about a quality that you have in someone else versus the way you see it in yourself. Right? That person acts angry because he's a horrible human being. I act angry because my mother really hurt me. Or flip it, if you're feeling horrible about yourself. That person deserves mercy. Look what he went through. But I had everything and I'm still a schmuck. Right? And the point here is that an awful lot lies in how one understands. The reasons are not, let's put it this way, the reasons are underdetermined. Right? You can look at a quality in someone and say, you know what? They're awful. I can't stand them anymore. You can say, you know what? Yetzer Adam Rami Nu'arav. By the way, I also made them. And so God has this sort of about face. But one of the things that I think is important here, and I do not want to underplay this sort of profound theological claim here, is that the endurance of the world, according to Genesis, is a function of divine mercy, not of anything human beings achieve. Right? The world, it is not just, put this in a different way. Many of you have heard me talk about many times about how the creation of the world is an act of grace, which elicits, ideally, a posture of gratitude. But the same thing is true about the endurance of the world. It's not just the creation of the world that is a function of divine grace, but also the endurance of the world. God chooses to see humanity through the eyes of generosity and allow the world to endure. Now, I don't have the time to develop this, so I just want to allude to it because I think it's kind of amazing. And this is based on the scholarship of a British Bible scholar named Walter Moberly. The same thing happens in Shemot after the sin of the golden calf, where God gets angry, because the Jewish people are amche oreth. They are stiff-necked. And then Moshe amazingly turns to God and says, you know why you should forgive them? Ki amche orethu. It's amazing. Moses throws it back at God and says, no, you don't you get it? You say they're stubborn. That's an explanation for how horrible they are. I'd like to finish with them. I say they're stubborn. What do you expect? And after all, you, God, are the God of the attributes. You are the God of forgiveness. Here, by the way, there's something amazing. Okay? That the Jewish people deserve and depend on exactly the same mercy as humanity as a whole depends on. There is nothing intrinsically better about the Israelites than there is about people as a whole. Everybody is problematic. The thing that keeps the world going is the same thing that keeps the covenant going, which is a reorientation from God's perspective. Seeing what used to be grounds for condemnation now is grounds for compassion and potentially even embrace. So let me just say a couple of very quick words in conclusion. The Bible has an enormously complex view of human possibility and potential. On the one hand, it is a theology of awesome responsibility, created in the image of God, asked to be God's earthly delegates, asked to shape our own lives, summoned to work for the flourishing of all creation, given vast room to create and develop culture and civilization, beckoned by God to participate in building the kind of world God dreams of. And yet, the Bible holds no brief for simplistic notions of intrinsic human goodness. Human beings are not intrinsically good. Human beings are not intrinsically bad. Human beings are intrinsically complicated. That, I think, is actually, despite the theology of Hebrew schools, right, which, as many of you have heard me talk about before, assumes that because it thinks that Christianity thinks people are bad, it must be that Judaism thinks people are good. Right? Right. I always like to say, the problem with those comparisons is that they falsify Judaism and Christianity. Besides for that, They're loaded with insight, right? In other words, it's totally wrong. The Bible's view is that human beings are enormously potentialed, and also they like to exult in killing a little child for hurting them. Human beings are complicated, capable of breathtaking kindness, as well as horrific cruelty and staggering indifference. Judaism's view, in other words, is that we're called upon to be world builders. God believes in our ability to renew ourselves and to make real and deep contributions to bringing about a just, decent, compassionate world. Participating in those projects is actually a large part of what it means to be human and to be Jewish, to hear and respond to that summons. But we're also asked to live with our eyes open, in full view of just how complicated both we are and the world is, and thus of how hard and elusive moral progress really is. That's part of what it means when Judaism emphasizes that we wait for the Messiah rather than pretending to be the Messiah. Now, lest I be misunderstood, waiting for the Messiah is not synonymous with being passive or succumbing to fatalism or despair. We wait by working and building and creating pockets in the world that anticipate the redemption that we and God dream about. And the way we do that is by committing our lives to causes that are greater than ourselves. That's the project of self-transcendence, of moving ourselves from the center. Genesis, however, reminds us just how hard and how constant that work is and will continue to be. Thank you. All right, so to follow on last week's plan, we'll take maybe three questions at a time, and then I'll try to evade some and answer others, if I can. No one? Yeah, please.
The first half of your talk, when you're laying out, speaking to that question, how God has a large project, and then he has a big idea, and then he talks to you, and it says that you go make it happen. And I feel like I couldn't help but think that the converse is also true. In the same way that, let's say, God is promising Abraham that at a certain point your descendants will be enslaved, and then I'll also take them out. The person that's taking them out is Moshe, but the person that's enslaving them is Paro. So on the one hand, when it's something positive, you're calling that, oh, look how great that we're partners in the project. Right. And then Paro, or even, you know, at a certain point when the Israelites have to be exiled, the Netzar shows up, right?
Right.
Then, are you also going to talk about those people as partners and how great is this human project that we're working with God?
Great.
I had one other small other comment, different. I thought it was interesting when you were bringing out source 6 and looking at it again, that when God takes Adam and says, you'll be able to name the animals, I think it's very interesting in verse 19 where it says, Vayser Elohim in Adamah kol chayat ha-shadeh, and then it says, and then it's very interesting, right? He says, God that creates all the animals, and then it's, what is it in English? You know, he wants to see what Adam will call them. It's almost like an interesting, it's not a purely, you call them something and then that'll be the name. What does it mean, what does that language really mean? To say, I kind of want to see what he's going to do with this. And I think that speaks to something that's not, you know, that's also interesting.
Okay, great. Yeah.
What do you think the implications are in God's reconsideration after the flood not to destroy man for the same reason that he did consider the destruction of the future, that the Reach and Koach? How do you interpret the pleasing odor as perhaps something that changes God's mind?
Yeah, I'd love to evade that one. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
This is kind of, it builds on that question a little bit. There's a very interesting relationship I see between chapter 8 and chapter 9, and actually this is Saul Herman's insight, not mine. But the first thing that Noah does is after the flood is he takes this korban, you know, and there's a lot. And one way of interpreting that is God says, we went to all this effort to save these animals. The first thing that Noah wants to do is to kill them and offer it as an offering. And God's reaction to that, if you go right into chapter 9, is man is basically evil from the start. but we have this other alternative plan. Let's make a compromise with man. Let's recognize his bloodthirstiness by acknowledging that man wants to eat meat, but at the same time set up a system of laws that will restrain his bloodlust.
Okay. Okay. So there are a lot of interesting questions here, most of which fall on the scale of evasions answering. They fall on the scale inside of evasion. Partners in evil, too. So, look, the Torah itself, right, famously Tanakh at one moment calls Nebuchadnezzar the rod of God's anger. In fact, if you're interested in post-Holocaust theology, you may know that when Richard Rubinstein famously wrote his book After Auschwitz about why he could no longer believe in God after the Holocaust, he actually talks about that pasuk and says, if I take biblical theology seriously, I have to talk about Hitler as a rod of God's will in some way. The fact is, he's wrong in the sense that, right, there's an awful lot of biblical texts that don't work on that assumption, right? Sometimes I imagine sort of Kohelet looking at him and saying, what are you talking about? Literally, I don't even know what you're saying. But in other words, but there are biblical precedents that do play that way. And I think what ends up happening for a Jewish theology is to figure out just how much you think it's important for a Jewish theology to hold that God is micromanaging the world, or whether the divine delegation at a certain point becomes more total, as opposed to giving human beings small roles to play in eliciting, you know, the larger divine drama that actually, right, on some level, God gives instructions, inspiration, and gets out of the way. Now, there's a lot at stake in that question, and literally, if we kind of explore that question, we'd be in the range of the question that all 20th century Jewish theologians fight about, except for those who want to evade it altogether, because it's too difficult. Right? So, in other words, there's two questions to ask, which is, what would the theology of those particular biblical texts be versus the theology of the broader Hebrew Bible? And then, what would a Jewish theology be today, and in what way is it a similar to or different from a biblical theology? Or those are two separate levels of complicating the question. The Torah tries to deal with this, successfully, philosophically or not, is it like a different kind of question, by saying, right, V'gam et hagoy asher yavodu dan anochi, right? That even though it is my will that the Israelites suffer, it is not necessarily my will that Pharaoh be the one who does it. Does that solve the problem? That's already in the abyss of the metaphysics of free will and divine foreknowledge, and I have a headache. No, I mean, it's just very, that's a big question. I'd be happy to talk about that, even give a lecture about that sometime, but that's huge. Now, waiting to watch, I've always understood that, to watch what Adam will do, I've always understood that, maybe wrongly, but I've always understood that as actually sort of bidafka, like an emphasis of, no, I really want to see what this agent does. It's a dramatic statement of, oh, here's a situation, let's see what Adam does. Right? It's a real, one of the biblical scholars who writes about this most beautifully is Phyllis Tribble, a very prominent feminist biblical scholar, who basically talks about this is the moment when God basically says, you know what? Yeah, I may be sort of theoretically omnipotent, but I don't want to be actively omnipotent in this way. I've got to make space. Otherwise, there's no relationships. So let's see what Adam does. The Reach Nichoach. Look, I don't know. This is one of those moments where I struggle with to what extent we should think historically and to what extent we should think normatively. So I want to say, the first thing about the Reach Nichoach is there's a way to read it primitively, that it's about, you know, appealing to God's senses and thereby changing God's mind. And there's another way of reading it that is somehow about what sacrifice in that moment represents and moving God in some way. By the way, some scholars point out, which I don't know how convincing this is, but I think it's really interesting, that the point of the Reach Nichoach there is actually to emphasize that God is smelling sacrifices but not eating them. That it's actually like a step towards the, I'm going to make up a word, the decrudification of theology. Right, it's about a much more subtle thing than food. Now, that doesn't solve the problem. By the way, Kabbalists eat this up, no pun intended, right? Because this is like the great text on the face of it, of theurgy. Theurgy, the idea that some human ritual can move God to act in some particular way. Right? Kabbalists love this. In fact, I mean, this is really like a digression, but it's sort of fun. One of the great forerunners of Zionism, Zvi Hirsch Alkali, famously argues in the 1830s already, we should buy from the Turks the Temple Mount. We should buy it, because we have no right to take it by force. We should buy it. And then he does this long halachic investigation to show that it's totally permissible to make a sacrifice even though there's no temple. And the reach nichoach of the sacrifice will force God to redeem us from our situation in Europe. Now, here's, by the way, one of the reasons I love that text in Kalsher. It's an amazing text of a guy who is moving towards modernity and also totally not there. How should we get to build a sacrifice? He writes, to offer a sacrifice, he writes a letter to Lord Rothschild and says, you're rich, buy the damn thing. Right? Totally modern means. Right? We're going to use politics, we're going to use economics, we're going to go, we're going to get the Temple Mount. And what are we going to do once we get the Temple Mount? Reach Michoach Lashem. It's an amazing moment of like, called transition to modernity, non-transition to modernity. It's an amazing, amazing moment. It's an 1839 letter to Baron Rothschild, which we don't even know if Baron Rothschild got, but we do know he didn't respond. Now, what you attributed, Scott, to Rabbi Berman is not, you know, it goes back much farther than that, right? The notion that Genesis 9 is, not to take anything away from Rabbi Berman, but in other words, it goes. Rabbi Berman is quoting a whole tradition of understanding Genesis 9 as a kind of concession, meaning, and we talked about this a little bit last time, Genesis 1 articulates the ideal of a vegetarian universe, maybe even a herbivoric universe, right? And Genesis 9, after the flood, basically says, okay, let's try to rein in human aggression by establishing laws to limit, and in particular, in that context, insisting on the non-eating of the blood, which is about establishing some degree of respect for life, even if it permits ending it. Now, in a certain kind of apologetic reading of the Jewish tradition, what kashrut is really about is that. I think it's one of the things kashrut is about. But the very fact that it's one of the things kashrut is about stands as a scathing indictment to the difficulty many people have trying to get the world of people who keep kosher to think about the way the world of treatment of animals in the process of preparing them for food causes unimaginable and largely unnecessary suffering. Right? In other words, the danger is always that when you set up laws in order to instantiate values, the laws stay and the values evaporate. That's the challenge of having any system that's about law. Right? That's, in many ways, that's what you've heard, many of you heard Rabbi Ethan Tucker talk about countless times. He's in some ways more optimistic than I am. But the point is, you know, yeah, that's the goal. But on some level, if you take that seriously, Jews who take the Bible seriously should be at the forefront of insisting that the world of, let's assume that eating meat is okay, right? Of insisting that the most humane ways of preparing meat conceivable are important. And that should be as financially urgent as buying a fancy etrog from Cyprus. Sorry. I just fell off my own soapbox. Yeah, sorry. Nobody else has anything to say? Huh? Yeah, please. And then.
I'm curious about going back to this chapter 6 and Genesis 8.
Yeah.
What to make of it seems like it's somewhat the same idea, but it's very different language that you both.
Good. Yeah, yeah. Good.
Whether there's some kind of change or modification.
Right. Good. All right. I will come back to that. Thank you for. I wanted to talk about that and simply like didn't feel I had enough time, but I will do that. Yeah. Please.
I created the following syllogism out of your talk, and tell me if it's correct.
By definition, no. I don't even know how to think syllogistically, let alone do it right. But yeah, try me. Yeah. Sure. Yeah.
A slave is someone who doesn't believe that he has the ability to determine his own fate. Christians don't have the ability to determine their own fate because they simply cannot do God's will. Therefore, Christians are slaves.
Okay. Yeah, okay, good. All right, I will respond to that in a moment. Are Christians slaves? That, please. Yeah.
I guess, ironically, it's a little bit related. I'm wondering about audience. That you're speaking about you're using Jewish language and calling it Jewish theology to address all of humanity. So I'm wondering...
Great, thank you.
Who's listening? And why is this done in Jewish language, if this is all humanity's role? And in turn, where do the Jews have a particular role, or are they just representative of one ethnic group, one cultural religion?
You know, I have to say that very few things make me as happy as the questions after these last two lectures. It's like, these questions are like, okay, so in the 2 minutes that you have, develop an entire Jewish theology of the history and the universe. Now, I know on some level these lectures ask for it, but it's great fun. It's like, I want to feel bad about my inability to answer these questions. At least I have time to hang it on, right? Okay, so first, Genesis 6 and Genesis 8. For those of you who want to look at the question, it's actually source 10. Genesis 6:5 talks about kol yetzer machshavot libo rak rak kol hayom. All rock, all only, or nothing but. And Genesis 8 seems to soften it. It drops kol and it drops rock. It drops the everything and it drops the nothing but. Now, there are a lot of ways to think about that. One of the things I think might be going on is that this is partially the Torah's way of saying that the perspective we hold in that moment actually affects how total the view we have of the other. Meaning, God, in the moment of utter disappointment with humanity and giving up on them, says, you know what? Everything about you just nauseates me. And after the flood, and I just realized I just set myself up here, but after the flood, God says, from a position of compassion, much about you nauseates me. Now, that's a stupid parallel, but I think the point is that in the mode of compassion, the language softens to reflect the shift in mood. Now, does that mean that God's perspective has also changed? So it's interesting. Some scholars, here I think I'm thinking more of academic scholars than Jewish interpreters traditionally, although I may be wrong about this. It's academic scholars that are coming to my mind anyway. Understand the introduction of Mine'urav from his youth. Some scholars take that to mean, oh, it's built into the human condition from their very earliest days. Other scholars say Mine'urav means it's not built into the human condition, it's a function of the circumstance they find themselves in. And so, introducing the word Mine'urav really is a softening of the claim about human nature. I don't feel like I know enough about this to really answer that question. But it seems to me that at least what's going on here is the language shifts to appropriate the mood, to approximate the mood. In some ways, it brings to mind to me the ways in which a variety of Hasidic texts understand a variety of Mishnayot in Pirkei Avot, and of the convoluted sentence about Kol Ha'adam, right? Have danet Kol Ha'adam lechavzchut, judge every person favorably. Rabbi Nachman of Bratslav famously understands that to mean judge the entirety of the person favorably. Or the Sfas Emes understands Al tihi vaz lechol adam, don't disdain any person. He understands that to mean don't disdain the entirety of a person based on one or two qualities that they have. In other words, I think there's a softening here that's about an orientation that what God learns, as it were, and I'm bracketing all the metaphysical questions that raises, but what God learns is how to see through generous eyes. And the language shifts appropriately or accordingly. Are Christians slaves? So first of all, the syllogism doesn't work for the following reason. The Christian claim would not be that Christians are slaves. The Christian claim, if you want to wrestle with it, is that human beings are slaves. Right? Because Christianity, for better and for worse, rarely makes claims about Christians. Right? This is one of the most interesting things a Jewish studies scholar has ever said in a footnote. Probably said this in this room more times than is polite. Daniel Boyarin, in a footnote to one of his books, says the following, I think, incredibly interesting thing. He says, you know, the history of Christianity is extremely strong at caring about everyone, but it's extremely bad. I did this really backwards. Let me do this differently. The history of Judaism is extremely good at leaving other people alone and letting them be who they are. And its Yetzer Hara is that it forgets to care about them an awful lot of the time. And Christianity is extremely strong at caring about everyone, but it has a really hard time learning how to leave anybody alone. It's an amazing sort of summation of the history of Jewish and Christian thought and of an awful lot of human bloodshed, right? Now, so the claim about human beings is that they're slaves. And I think actually that many Christian theologians in the history of Christian thought would say, pshita, mao detema. Like, what would be the other possibility? Human beings are, that's why they need Christ to save them. Because we are fundamentally, irredeemably sinful. We are enslaved to our, depending on who you're talking about, carnal, selfish nature. So I think Christians would say, yeah, and you know what? We'd be better off if we admitted it. How many times, not you, how many times have you decided that you're going to be totally different beginning right now? How many times have you done that? And you're lucky if it lasts 8 minutes. I always like to call that the morning after Yom Kippur. I wake up and I'm still me. It's like a heartbreaking moment. Right? So Christianity is actually onto something that you, rather than sort of push aside, probably all of us in different moments can relate to in different extents. It's just like, oh my God, I'm just like, right? By the way, what is AA about on some level? I can't do it. Can't do it. Now the irony is, that's what becomes empowering. Okay, I understand. But so in other words, I think that the syllogism, I don't know if it's really a syllogism, but the syllogism works in a certain way, which is, how free are we? That's another version of my point, right? Which is that Jewish theology, I think, thinks we have the potential to be free, to act freely. Now, the audience. So, one of the verses in the Torah that was most important to the Rambam was Deuteronomy 4:6, I think it is. Am I right about that? The Torah, Deuteronomy describes how the nations should look at the Torah, and they will say, "Ki hi chochmatchem uvinatchem le'inei hagoyim," because the Torah is your wisdom in the eyes of the nations. For the Rambam, that is the scriptural basis for an obligation to explain the rationality of every mitzvah. Because if the mitzvot have no rationale, nobody could look at them and say, oh, I get it. This is why Leibovitz, for example, those who are interested in this, gets the Rambam so totally wrong on this point. Right? If nothing means anything other than obedience, the Rambam says, so who's going to look at you and say, oh, wow. Right? This is wisdom. Of course, then comes the flip side, right? The challenge to the Rambam is, if you start giving a reason for everything, people will end up saying, okay, I got the reason, I no longer need the ritual. Question I think the Rambam spent many nights worrying about. But that is, I think, really on some level fundamental to Dvarim, and especially to the Rambam. Now there, he's talking about mitzvot. But I would say something else, playing with the same psukim. Being Jewish never supersedes being human, right? It builds on, it expands, it transforms, but it never supersedes being human. Just as, I'll say it in an interesting, I think an interesting way, just as I tried to argue last time that being human never supersedes being part of the natural order, being an animal, but rather transforms and deepens what that means, being Jewish, I'm not making a parallel that I hope you're not drawing here, okay? I'm just trying to draw a certain kind of logic that becoming one thing doesn't mean losing the other thing that you fundamentally are. So I think that there has to be, some of the core theological claims of Torah have to speak to the human condition and not just to the Jewish condition. And I think the Torah itself makes that claim by deferring Avraham's emergence until after some of the best stories are over. Right? Now, why does it have to be said in a Jewish language? I don't know that it does. The particular things I'm saying in these lectures don't have to be said in a particular Jewish language. I would be very happy if more people said these things in different languages. That said, right, I'm not just looking for Jewish sources to just say what I already think. Now, everyone is guilty of that to some extent, but as I talked about last time, when I started out working on a chapter of my book and a lecture about Tzelem Elohim, the last thing in the world I thought I'd be talking about was environmental responsibility. Right? It's actually where trying to figure out what Bereshit Aleph led me to. So first of all, you know, I would say the reason why it's Jewish is because I'm Jewish, I believe in Torah, and I'm trying to figure out what Torah says about being human, in addition to, which I'll say in a minute, what it says about being Jewish. I tried subtly to suggest one of the many ways that Torah does this by pointing to the parallel between Noah and the flood and the Israelites after Chetah Egel, to say, which is like on some level, we'd never become anything else, right? We're stubborn humans like everyone else. I don't know what this means, but my teacher Yitzchak always loves to say, right, when you grow up, you realize that Jews are like everybody else, only more so. Right? I don't exactly know what it means, but I find it sort of like an interesting thing to think about. So, I want other people to come to some of the same, I hope, wisdom about what it means to be human. But I'm committed not just to using Jewish language to do it, but to try and listen very closely to what Judaism says about it. Now, what does Judaism add? That's a different set of lectures. The next book, God help us, is about, okay, so why is there a covenant between God and the Jewish people? But again, the covenant does not supersede. Not only does the covenant not supersede, the covenant has to have repercussions for all of humanity, as God tells Avram in the very first moment. Right? V'nitbarchu b'cha kol mishpachot ha'adama is a claim that all the nations of the earth, now nobody knows how to translate v'nitbarchu b'cha. Does it mean they shall be blessed through things you do, they shall invoke your name as a blessing? And how we translate that has huge implications. But I think one of the things that the covenant clearly claims is that the more particularistic you become, you must never lose sight of your fundamental humanity and the fact that the God whom you worship is a God of humanity and not of the Jewish people, or not only of the Jewish people, right? As I like to say somewhat crudely, God is not just a big Jew. God is not a patron God. God is a God who loves widows and orphans, sof pasuk. And as the stories in Bereshit make clear, right, it is Abraham and Sarah who are the first to oppress the stranger, Hagar, otherwise known as Hagar, which is the point of her name, right? In other words, the human condition is shared by Jews. The propensity to evil, the possibility of goodness, is all built into the covenant. Now, what is the covenant? We can have that lecture and conversation. The covenant is about a particular engagement that God makes with a particular people to try and build now an instantiation of the world God envisions to cover all of the earth one day. Right? It's about, on some level, what happens when God says, you know what, and we can sort of analyze what we mean by this metaphysically, but you know what? Working with all of humanity is not working out so well. So why don't I start small? Now, that doesn't work out so well either. This is why you have something called the later prophets. Right? But what keeps happening, if you read with a kind of open heart and an open mind, is every time you want to say there's kind of some essential difference that makes Jews better than anybody else, the Torah laughs at you. I mean, again and again, Tanakh laughs at you. That doesn't stop many Jewish teachers from making that argument. And one of the things I think you find, you know, if you allow yourself to read in different worlds, is how deeply all of us are impacted by the cultural places where we read. Right? So, you know, in certain settings, I say, you know, oh, Genesis 16 He's about Abraham and Sarah being the first oppressors of the stranger. She's a ger. The word is inui, right? Oppression. And she's also an ebed. She's a shifcha. She has all three of the aspects of covenant that God says specify what the Jewish people are. And by the way, it's not me. Ramban and Radak say the very same thing, right? It's a horrific sin. Ramban actually says, in a shocking moment, that moment is responsible for the whole history of anti-Semitism. It's a shocking. I don't exactly know what he means by that. I think that has to do with his desire to have this kind of like paradigmatic moment that is responsible for all the rest of history. Now, I am now giving you a very rambling response as a way of saying that the covenant builds on, but does never supersede, the fundamental covenant between God and humanity and God and the whole earth. So that's what we have to stipulate to start out. Then we can talk about a different lecture for a different time, which will make, you know, some people very happy and some people very nervous. What does it mean to talk about, in biblical language, of God electing one people? Right? Because what Genesis 12 is about, okay, not to put too fine a point on it, is God falls in love with someone. That's what Genesis 12 is about. And then we have to think about what are we going to do with that? We're going to make sense of that. How do you make sense of that in a contemporary idiom? But it never supersedes. In halachic language, it's one of the reasons why many sources emphasize that there's nothing in the world that Jews can ever be permitted that the rest of the world would be forbidden morally. That's another language for saying the same thing, right? The Torah is supposed to build on and deepen rather than ever supersede the moral obligations that define us as human. I know I didn't obviously fully answer your question, but okay. What time is it? Do we have, what time is it? 9 o'clock. Okay, should I take one last comment? No, let's not take one. We have people who want to go home. Thank you all very much.